Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. This is Tho Bishop. No Ryan for this episode, but I'm joined by my good friend, Mises U alum, and policy director for the Sound Money Defense League, JP Cortez. JP, how are you doing?
Hey, Tho, I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing great, doing great. Excited for this episode. Joe Biden earlier this week, I think, made a statement that had some legitimacy. We will occasionally admit that on this show. He was talking about how Republicans really don't have any sort of solution for the inflation question. Earlier this week, we saw Republicans sign off with the rest of the Democrats, kind of the uniparty at action with a $40 billion Ukrainian bill. Those same Republicans will be going out there today talking about Biden inflation, seeing no connection, how one leads to the other. No surprise there. But I think that does open up a very interesting policy environment where, there for all of the money pumped into D.C., very little attention is placed on the monetary issue. Even people kind of within our orbit, there's a lot of intellectual pursuits. And obviously, the Mises Institute has many scholars dedicated to some of that. But it strikes me that the idea that we're going to come in and reform the Fed with some sort of new generation of free market monetary thinkers is perhaps even more delusional, if you will, than any sort of faith in electoral politics. And that's why I'm always excited to see the updates from what you've been doing for several years now. And I know we were talking off air how you've had a busy year, but issues dealing with real money in a better world, right? Gold and money, how there's things that we can do at the state level to help support alternatives to the dollar. And then, of course, federal issues are going to be a kind of a different thing itself. But JB, can you just tell a little bit with our audience here, what it is the Sound Money Defense League does and what are some of the projects that you've been working on?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Sound Money Defense League is a national nonpartisan policy project that was started in about 2016. So for about 7 years now, we have worked to remonetize gold and silver, a constitutional sound money. And what we have found is that there is so much that states can do to help alleviate some of the damage that's done on the federal level by the feds and the Federal Reserve. And so the easiest way that we've found to remonetize gold and silver is through state laws and taxation. There's a lot of taxation surrounding the use, the purchase, the sale of gold and silver. And so the dysfunction that we're seeing here today on as far as these unseen levels of inflation in several decades, stem from the federal level, absolutely no doubt. But states don't have to be a party, don't have to be victim to the damage done by the states. So the plan is to knock down any state impediments to buying, owning, selling precious metals. So that's in some states, there are states that charge sales tax when you purchase precious metals. In most states and on the federal level, you're going to get hit with an income tax. If you sell when there's a gain, you have to report that gain and you're taxed on that. And there are just plenty of disincentives to keeping people from using gold and silver as money, using them as an inflation hedge, which it has been for thousands of years. And so states are waking up to the fact that they can do something about this problem. While the problem is largely a federal one, they can still do things to mitigate the damage. And more than ever, we're seeing states, individuals within those states, the politicians within those states, and even states themselves, realizing that gold and silver today, more than ever, at a time of high inflation and geopolitical uncertainty, is unbelievably important. And so to remove any of the penalties to getting into that are of the utmost importance, and states are realizing that, and laws all over are being passed to remove sales taxes, remove disincentives, remove any of the friction into and out of the U.S. dollar.
So can you talk about some of the progress you've been making this year? I know Alabama, you had a big victory there on a sales tax exemption, right, for gold
exactly.
and silver. I think Virginia was another battleground that you guys had this year. Can you talk about some of the states that you've had some success, not only this year, but perhaps some recent years prior to this?
Yeah, absolutely. So just this year that we have been busy, the Sound Money Defense League has been working 24 pieces of legislation across 11 different states. This is legislation that tackles the sales tax issue, the capital gains issue. These are laws or bills that tackle the legal tender issue. States that want to form, establish their own gold bullion depository in the state. States that want to hold some of their taxpayer funds, their pension funds, their reserve funds in physical gold and silver held within the state. So there are plenty of projects right now that are going on. And yeah, as you mentioned, most recently, I'm happy to say Alabama had already had an exemption on gold and silver. They had already decided that taxing the purchase of precious metals is wrong and inappropriate. There is no other asset that Alabama taxes the purchase of. So when you buy real estate or stocks or bonds, ETFs, mutual funds, you're not going to pay a sales tax on that good. And that's because sales taxes are applied to final consumed goods. These are goods that are held for resale. So it makes no sense and it isn't appropriate to charge a sales tax. And fortunately, Alabama's legislature decided that they were going to extend the law that already existed. There was a sunset date that was coming up, and they decided to push that back. Virginia did something similar as well. They had had a standing law that was being edited to push back the sunset to push it out. And then, honestly, I was hoping to be able to break some news here on the show today. But the Tennessee legislature has recently passed a law eliminating sales tax on gold and silver coins and bars. Tennessee was one of the remaining 9 states in the United States. There were only 9 states left that still charge this unfair sales tax. And Tennessee, we're waiting on the governor's signature. Unfortunately, he has not signed it into law yet, but there is good news to report from the volunteer state.
Now, there you go. Like any progress we'll take, particularly when there's very little being made in many other areas of the world. But
yeah, absolutely.
Since you guys have been at this for a while, how has there been any difference in the way that your interactions with like state legislators have gone, particularly this past year and a half, now that inflation has gone from, you know, kind of the unseen as it was for a decade, you know, a lot of warnings about what Federal Reserve mismanagement was going to do. You know, a lot of the ways that we've seen inflation for the past, you know, decade plus has been in assets and things like that. Still very big stuff, but it doesn't quite, you know, that's kind of the unseen, where it's the seen is what we're seeing right now every time we go to the, you know, gas pump or the grocery store, yada, yada, yada. You know, are normal sort of state legislators kind of picking up on the significance of this issue, or is it still something that kind of gets by where you might have a few small, you know, like a small number of maybe passionate people that care and they kind of lead in? What's been the relationship with state legislators?
I'm happy to say that the relationship has grown tremendously. Every year that we've done this, we are met with good support from, you know, principled politicians that are many times hearing from people in the state and deciding that they want to carry a bill to do something like this. And every time I go to testify before these committees or I'm in contact with any of these legislators, they largely are way more interested than they used to be. And inflation is something at the top of their mind now that they had never considered before. And now they're saying, wait a second, they're right. And My testimony in these conversations that the Sound Money Defense League has and gets to communicate with these legislators, you know, is not it's not the very surface level antiseptic, like, hey, inflation's bad and you should stop this. It's, you know, me testifying before committees telling them, hey, listen, this process, this inflationary process, this process that doesn't allow for capital accumulation, this process that values high velocity trash in metrics as far as money goes, this process is keeping capital accumulation from happening and you're ruining generations. This is not a policy that is going to harm today. This is not a policy that is going to be able to be done away with, you know, by the stroke of a pen, the stroke of a pen of a president. You know, this is something that has really, really horrible ripple effects out. And getting to talk to these politicians, you know, often all across the country, we're finding that these people are becoming more and more afraid of inflation. It's no longer a deniable problem. You know, so we had experts, quote unquote, these experts telling us at first there is no inflation. And then they told us inflation was transitory. And then they told us inflation was good for the working class. And now they're telling us inflation is the Putin price hike. That's what all of this is. And I'm happy to say that it's becoming harder and harder to deny that this is a mere problem of government ineptitude. That these prices, what we're seeing here, it's not coincidence that trillions of dollars have been printed out of thin air over the last 2 or 3 years, and we're seeing inflation rates unlike anything we've seen in decades. This is not something that happens by chance. And more people are waking up to that.
And then one of the things I think is interesting is that, you know, again, you know, money for the longest time, we you know, I remember back in, you know, the Ron Paul campaign days, right? You know, it was the dismissal of money as sort of like this wonkish, you know, very, very high-minded, high intellectual sort of item that would never like resonate with the base. And part of that, you know, there was a very interesting book, The Lords of Easy Money, that I read recently about some of the history of particularly the Greenspan Fed and the Bernanke Fed. Unfortunately, everything the author, when the author gives his own economic opinion in that book, it gets cringy very quickly. But one of the things, though, I appreciate that they highlight is the degree to which it was a deliberate tactic of Alan Greenspan and Bernanke to use language when testifying in front of Congress, when talking to the public during, you know, meetings with financial press and things like that. Like they would intentionally use language designed to confuse and kind of hide the real mechanics of what they were doing. And I think that has played a long way in trying to detach money from politics. But of course, historically, you know, this was a major issue, obviously, not only with the Jacksonians, but, you know, you had McKinley being, you know, carried in a litter of a gold coin, you know, back in the day on prominent campaign, you know, literature and things like that. You know, particularly, and I think now some parallels of what we have right now, the degree to which inflation was a cause for protests throughout the country during the stagflation environment, late 70s. You know, it is interesting to see, you know, particularly with this era of American politics, particularly on the right, that is becoming, I think, explicitly populist, at least in rhetoric, if not action. You know, the degree to which this carries over to the money issue, because, you know, this really is one of those issues that, again, you know, something, one of the few times you see the consequences of policy play out every single day. I mean, this is the ultimate kitchen table issue. And yet, you know, it's something that most political, you know, politicians have no opinion on, at least haven't had an opinion on until late. Has there been, you know, you mentioned that along with the tax aspect of it, you know, you guys have been focusing on, I know, I think Texas was the first state to have a gold depository. Some, you know, what is the landscape out there for some of these even more ambitious steps being taken in this environment from some of the states? I know you have an index of kind of which states are best performing in some of your sound money metrics from a policy standpoint. What are some of the other legislative pitches out there that you think are interesting on top of the way that, you know, states may treat gold or silver as a, you know, say a sales tax issue?
Sure. Yeah. So real quick to something you were saying earlier about, you know, this is the ultimate kitchen table conversation. And until recently, the experts, the authorities, you know, haven't really had anything to say about it. And I think I was speaking to someone, I think it was Eric Brakey over at YAL. And we were talking about how, you know, this is, money tends to be one of those subjects, one of those issues that is almost, you know, kept exclusively for the experts. Like, oh, you're not a PhD. You know, haven't studied economics. You haven't read Thomas Piketty's latest book. You know, stay in your lane. And it has now normal everyday people who haven't, you know, don't have PhDs in economics and don't haven't studied at elite schools are finding themselves saying, hey, wait a second. I knew that this was coming. I said that this money was going to be an inflationary event. And what do you mean the experts are surprised that inflation has caught us like this? This makes no sense to the normal people. So even normal people, and I think we're sort of seeing this in America as a whole, the faith or, yeah, I guess the faith in experts seems to be waning, and people are starting to think for themselves more, you know, across all matter of topics. But to your question, I think that the sales tax issue and the tax issue generally is going to be the easiest to tackle. That's the easiest to get victories in. It's the one that's probably simplest for people to understand. But there is, for example, right now, we are hurtling towards a massive pension crisis in this country, where pensions are so largely underfunded. And as people begin to retire, this is going to become a problem. And a lot of the problem with the underfunding has to do with projections. These are asset managers that are promising 12, 13% a year. And it's just, it's not, when these are your plans, it's difficult to make that prediction become true. And then when you can't do it, you've got millions of people depending on you to somehow make up the difference. And so there are states that are introducing legislation to allow for physical gold and silver in these accounts. In many states, it's not just citizens that are hamstrung from purchasing and owning gold and silver to protect themselves from inflation. It's also the state themselves many times. The state is tied up, handcuffed by many times what are called alternative investment rules or prudent investor rules that don't allow for physical precious metals many times. And these are rules that allow for all sorts of, dollar denominated debt and third world debt and all of these, highly volatile, risky assets. These are allowed. The money managers say that's allowed, but a single ounce of gold, you're looked at like you have multiple heads, like you're from another planet. And so these kind of efforts that they're being introduced, all over the place, out in Idaho, in Oklahoma, in Wyoming. So we have these liberty legislators that are seeing the importance of having gold and silver to back their accounts, having gold and silver to back the state, the land that they love, being able to secure the assets of their place of residence has never been more important. And so people are flocking to it.
I'm so glad you mentioned the pension fund issue. I know this is also like, and that's one of the aspects of kind of the non-immediate, like sort of devaluating aspects of currency devaluation aspects of the insane monetary policy. Not only the Fed, but the ECB and every other major central bank out there, besides a select few. It's the degree to which when you're in such a low interest rate environment, the degree to which you have to take on higher yield assets to make up for the liabilities that you're going to eventually have to pay out, mm-hmm. which requires these institutions to load up on riskier and riskier debt. Now, I particularly enjoy the irony of ECB policy being directly responsible for European banks loading up on Russian debt, which is not going quite too well right now, right?
It's the snake that eats its tail. Yeah. And I think, it reminds me of there's the dollar trilemma, this idea when you live in an inflationary environment, when the country of origin is printing dollars the way America is, people, holders of the dollars have three options. You can get your dollars and hold them and be charged with a tax, an inflationary tax, a penalty for saving your money. You can spend immediately and try to get as much value out of your depreciating monetary unit as you possibly can. So you spend immediately, or you throw it into the risky casino that is the stock market, and you try to beat the dealer. And so none of these three options are what you want when you're talking about a society that you want to be growing, right? Like I mentioned earlier, it's just this high velocity idea that, GDP rules all. And so long as so long as unemployment is low, things are zipping along, we have no problem. And it's far more than that. And more, I think, people that are holding the dollar here and overseas are starting to say, hey, wait a second, this exorbitant privilege that I've been hearing about for a long time, why is it like this? And America is frankly at risk of losing reserve currency status. I wouldn't be able to say when in the next year, in the next decade, but more and more, the moribund dollar, the life of this dollar is coming to an end.
Yeah, it's interesting when those warnings are coming, not simply from, our circles, but, again, I'd love to point this out, but it was 2018 when the Bank of England was saying, hey guys, the Fed isn't playing above board here. The dollar is being weaponized against us. I think it was, you even had Federal Reserve officials earlier this year saying, oh, well, it's possible to have more than one global reserve currency. and of course, I think that you're going to end up seeing, particularly within this populist moment. This, in some cases, you know, more explicitly a nationalist one. You know, I think modern politics is going to be increasingly defined by the money question. Obviously, we've seen it not only play out in some of the blowback from bad economic policy and the war in Ukraine has only made that much much broader since it's now a full-fledged world financial war. Mm-hmm. But you know, even beyond that, the degree to which we've seen the banking system more broadly, I mean, explicitly weaponized for political purposes, the increasing need for powerful bureaucrats and kind of the technocratic class to rein in free speech and to crack down on political dissidents. The banking sector is one of those ways that they can do it. And that goes into some of the broader concerns about, shifting from to central bank digital currencies and all the fun, very a Chinese CCP style tools mm-hmm. and tricks that can come with some of that.
Canada is such a good example of that, right? The truckers protest and seeing how quickly people can be othered, by literally the snap of a finger, the decision of, I don't know who, an elected person, whoever it is, that can just other you and just cut off your lifeline, your access to a financial system. And it speaks to the need for trustless institutions in money, in government. Like the idea that these institutions rely on a good man, a good leader, a good woman in charge for the institution to be working properly is a recipe for disaster. And given man's propensity for sin, it doesn't make sense to build institutions that can be weaponized. And so trustless institutions in the form of Bitcoin, things like decentralized money, things like gold standards, these are the things I think that really smart people are working on to build. And that's what I'm excited about. That's why I'm bullish on the market. The market is going to outmaneuver the government. The governments are reactionary institutions. They react to what people do. And I think people are largely smarter.
Well, that's particularly since you touched on the Bitcoin issue there. I see that Wyoming is the best performer in your sound money index. Wyoming, of course, I think the great Caitlin Long, mm-hmm. the work that she helped push alongside the Wyoming state legislature, when wasn't her by herself necessarily, but the intellectual laid the intellectual foundation for a whole litany of a very interesting, liberating Bitcoin and crypto legislation, both from a regulatory side of things. I believe they opened up the ability for some government institutions to hold Bitcoin in their balance sheet as well, kind of getting to some of those issues that we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. What else has Wyoming done on sort of the gold, the sound money issue? That makes it the leader over a Texas or Alabama or some South, some of these other states that you've had success in. Is there anything in particular that we can learn from Wyoming as an example? Because they seem to be right on the frontier of really taking it to the Fed these days.
Yeah. Wyoming has been fantastic on this issue, from gold to Bitcoin to crypto generally. And you mentioned, Caitlin didn't work by herself, and you're right about that. But I think it was 2017. I was out in Wyoming. I was in Cheyenne, walking the halls of the state legislature, trying to get meetings, trying to pass a bill that eliminated all taxes on gold and silver coins and bars in Wyoming. Sales tax, income tax, any sort of property tax, any occupational, any anything. Any tax liability was zero on gold and silver. And we we're able to find many allies within the legislature. And at the same time, while we were working this sound money bill, Caitlin was there working her first, I think it was a blockchain bill. And so we were working the bills at the same time. And so I can tell you, she did not work alone, but man, she is a soldier. She is, marching up and down. She is out there every day, pounding the pavement, having these conversations, writing these, incredible articles and assets. And so, yeah, she is of Mises fame. I met her here at the Mises Institute in 2015, maybe 2014.
Patrick Byrne, AERC year right there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So Wyoming, I'm happy to say that Caitlin obviously has, been blowing everything out of the water in Wyoming as far as, you know, regulatory structures that allow for things like Bitcoin banks, regulatory structures that allow people to transact in, allow companies to hold, allow balance sheets, allow, you know, the governments, the state themselves to hold Bitcoin if they wanted to. So Caitlin has been obviously the leader on that front. And it's coupled with what Wyoming is doing there. And then in our index, what is sales tax, income tax, low levels of taxation at that, states that have codified, reaffirmed that gold and silver are indeed money. These are all things that Wyoming has checked. And that's what makes Wyoming the leader in the most recent Sound Money Index.
So do you ever get any sort of perhaps a generational sort of push there where, you know, perhaps, you know, with Bitcoin particularly, you know, coming on the mainstream in recent years, and, you know, yeah, it's always funny when you see, you know, whoever the intern is running the social media account of, you know, a politician, they'll put on laser eyes, you know, outside of Cynthia Lumens, I don't really trust that any of them are that well read on the issue. But when you're dealing, when you're specializing with silver and gold, which have some benefits over Bitcoin, not only in just being, you know, tangible, which I think makes a big deal with some people, but yet the constitutional aspect. I remember Ed Vieira gave a wonderful talk that Ron Paul's office sponsored back, I believe it was in 2012 or so, when I was still on the Hill, that did a great, you know, kind of historical breakdown and was advocating a lot of the similar stuff that you guys are pushing in terms of using the Constitution as itself an argument for these beyond any sort of economic sort of logic being used. Do you get any sort of generational sense where you're perhaps younger legislators, do they still see the value in gold relative to, say, a Bitcoin? Do you find some older legislators that might be more comfortable with say, like, you know, putting gold on the balance sheet than, like, you know, funny internet money that they don't really understand? Like, what's that sort of dynamic that you deal with dealing with some of these legislatures in this sort of larger battleground of depoliticized money, if you will?
Yeah, I think so. There are definitely different camps on that. There are definitely the legislators out there that, you know, firmly, whether it be because they believe in the Constitution or because they, you know, sat around their kitchen table and grew up learning that gold is money. You know, there is a camp that believes gold and silver are fundamentally different from something like a Bitcoin and Ethereum, any other of these digital currencies. And so there, I think, are people in legislatures that will vote differently because of that. But the reality is that politically, the policy that governs these two assets is incredibly different. The frameworks that, because Bitcoin has no infrastructure, so they're building banking frameworks and regulatory frameworks and all these different kinds of structures so that Bitcoin can live. And so I think a lot of people that are anti-Bitcoin, as far as legislators go, aren't necessarily anti-Bitcoin. They just don't understand the nuances, the wrinkles, all of the things that go into creating an entirely new financial system. And that scares off a lot of politicians, a lot of states even. You know, states don't want to be leaders. States don't want to be the first state to pass something. States want to hear, oh my gosh, we've had great success in 30 other states doing this policy. Okay, now we'll adopt it, right? And so it every now and then you have one of these firebrands, you know, that comes out and really makes a strong push for it. But I think largely there is a more so on the right, I would say, like an understanding of sound money and at least, you know, a sort of feigned respect towards, you know, reduced deficits and like lowering spending. But largely, I think the politicians are, you know, endless spenders, regardless, by and large. And, you know, if they're going to prefer something, and you're probably right in that age probably does have a lot to do with it. It probably divides along those lines pretty well. But there is a sound money group of legislators that likes gold, that doesn't like Bitcoin. There are probably sound money legislators that like Bitcoin, that don't like gold. So it's definitely a mixed bag.
Do you see any sort of partisan breakdowns? You talked about the difference between politicians that are confused or perhaps don't fully understand, don't have the confidence necessarily to act on something like Bitcoin, as a different category than those who are adamantly against it. And I think that is an important distinction. It's interesting because I know at the federal level you've had some of the legislators that have been the most savvy on the issue, once upon a time, there were several, Democrats kind of prominently out there for it. One of them being Jared Polis, who's now the governor of Colorado, who was original founding member of the Blockchain Caucus that they started. You have a little bit of that sort of, progressive tech bro sort of vibe, a little bit of like the Andrew Yangish sort of vibe that's out there with some Democrats. And yet then you also have on the other side, the view that, kind of puts anything that they can't control as being the embodiment of white supremacy, right? Whatever the generic evil of the day is, that's what Bitcoin is, because they can't control it. Do you see that dynamic play out at the state level, or is there perhaps, I could see an argument where the incentive structure, Ryan and I have talked a lot about the differences between how the operations are in state legislatures relative to the circus of Congress. Is there perhaps at the federal level an incentive structure for some of these Democrats going for national donations to make these big, ridiculous, absurd displays over being very angry at, whatever Peter Thiel or Elon Musk like? Or is there still a... let's call it a pragmatic, type of democratic legislator out there that is open to conversations, perhaps not only in Bitcoin, but gold, silver? Or is this, in your experience, tends to be something that is a Tea Party, Ron Paul, constitutionalist sort of a remnant in your style of politician?
You know what? I don't think that sound money is a partisan issue. Sound money is political, but it is not partisan. What I mean by that is that for the last 6 years, I have worked in Tennessee to pass legislation, and it was here on the seventh year of trying that we finally passed it. Alternatively, we've introduced legislation in places like Hawaii, places like New Jersey, places like Pennsylvania that have passed out of committees overwhelmingly, unanimously. So I don't believe that this is drawn across party lines. And in fairness, to the extent that they need fairness, to like the progressives who build a campaign, who build a personality around being mad at Elon Musk, there, I think, is, especially in the Bitcoin space, there's a lot of, I don't want to call it outright grifting, but a lot of politicians that are, pounding themselves on the chest, calling themselves lovers of Bitcoin and, calling themselves sound money advocates. And these guys wouldn't know Hazlitt from Hayek. And so you have a lot, I think you have a lot of pretenders. And I think that's the nature of politics, right? Because we're talking about a popularity contest. So to the extent that these things can make you more popular among your base, it makes sense to adopt them. If the game you're playing is one of ethics or morals or anything other than political gain, yeah, okay, that's a different conversation. But
since we've talked about the state level stuff, one of the last topics I want to talk with you is federal level stuff. Do you guys do much on the federal level at all? Do you guys see perhaps given everything that we've talked about with the political environment and the way that, again, inflation being the number one issue in America right now, do you see an opportunity there for perhaps some action at the federal level? I know one of my favorite all-time pieces of legislation from Ron Paul was his competing currency bill, which I preferred over, in the Fed, obviously, is a great book title, and that's the goal, right? But it's a little, harder to pass. You talk about lack of courage at the state level. You have it takes a whole lot of level of courage at the federal level, which is even less in supply there. Even audit the Fed, I've got my own political reasons for preferring the public to be afraid of the big spooky bank that we can't audit rather than trying to explain an actual central bank audit, even if there's a lot of good information, a lot of genuine scandals that you find. I remember there was a temporary, there was a limited audit after Dodd-Frank, where like, you know, Zero Hedge was like full of days, like how much, you know, how much we were bailing out European banks. And like, this should have been like a massive scandal, but you know, it's a little harder to explain, you know, the actual practices of central banking, even though, yeah. But the competing currency bill accomplished at, or was attempting to accomplish at the national level, a lot of the stuff that you're doing here at the state level, particularly with the way that gold, silver, I believe it, this was kind of right when Bitcoins became big, maybe cryptocurrency would have to be added. But eliminating that federal capital gains tax, which is something that, you know, this, the beauty of this is something that can be done on a tax bill that requires 50 plus one votes rather than 60 votes, or, you know, stacking the Fed with a bunch of intellectuals, that are sympathetic to some of these views, which are hard to find, with NDC. Do you guys see an opportunity at that federal level to perhaps strike where the iron's hot in some of this stuff?
I certainly hope that there is an opportunity, and there are people in Congress that are making this their chief issue, or among their chief issues. Congressman Alex Mooney from West Virginia just won his primary yesterday.
Yes. A contested one against a fellow member.
I'm sorry, what?
That was a contested primary against another sitting Republican member. It was a fun, throwdown.
Yeah, but now coming up in a mansion, we'll see how that race plays out. So Congressman Mooney has been championing the sound money issue on the federal level here for several years. You know, he has introduced legislation to do things like audit the Fed, to not just audit the Fed, but audit the gold, audit Fort Knox and do an assay, an actual test of the gold, and then requires the Federal Reserve or the Treasury to write a report and to explain what gold in here is allocated where? Is any of this gold encumbered? Is it swapped? Is it leased? Is it does someone else partially own this gold? Does it have any encumbrances upon it? And so Mooney, through that, and then obviously the Sound Money Caucus, Warren Davidson started the Sound Money Caucus probably 18 months ago now. And we've had calls with them as well to kind of talk about how we can work together and what we can do to educate the federal politicians. Like you mentioned, and I guess like I mentioned, it is unbelievably difficult to get anything done on the federal level. It is like walking through quicksand, walking through mud. It is impossible to get anything done. The gridlock makes it impossible. And that's why I think, for us at least, the idea that doing it on the state level would be more effective, that's why that was so appealing to us. And I think that seems to be the strategy, the way to do it. Like, federally, we're not going to get anything done. So pass laws on the state level. Go smaller, go more community-based, because that's where you can actually make a change. And that's why I encourage people to be an active participant in their legislature. Like, yeah, who you vote for president is probably not going to be the vote that makes a difference, but you can make actual change at the local level to affect policies that actually affect your life.
I got to rattle the saber a little bit here in Florida, because for all of the other areas where DeSantis has led on some of these issues, we have not seen a lot of action on the money issue, even though
you got Suarez down there.
Yeah. Well, we're trying. Yeah, the Miami mayor, he's doing some interesting stuff. Though he was an anti-DeSantis Republican back in the day.
Interesting.
Which matters only because of the degree of which, you know, it influences some of his power and when he can get in at Tallahassee. But
sure.
We spend every year the state buys, I think, like $30 million of foreign debt from one specific country, and it's like, man, we got to stop doing that. Stop buying these government bonds. Let's get some, at the very least, get some gold.
Yeah, and so Florida,
I think gold could be.
I'm glad you brought this up, because Florida, I'm sad to say, has one of the most egregious wrinkles in all of these laws. Most states have passed what we call full exemptions of gold and silver. Florida is one of six states that has what we call a threshold. In the law, it says that if you buy gold and silver in Florida, if the order is above $500, it's tax-free. There's no tax. But if you're buying in small amounts, under $500, you're charged a tax. So the dollar cost investors, the people who are buying a couple Silver Eagles at a time, you know, every paycheck, these are people that are taxed. And the big over $500 are not taxed. And so I know you're big down in the Florida scene. If you know anyone who wants to end this ridiculous, outdated practice in Florida, please have them call me.
So, JP, before we go, one other thing that is a housekeeping issue with the work that you guys do. I know that there is a essay contest on Sound Money that you guys do every year. We've had a lot of great Mises U alums win it in the past. Looking at some of the judges you have for this year, I see some familiar names. Can you talk a little bit about the essay contest and how can our audience... if you made it this far to the episode, then you're probably one of the people that could actually write a full essay on the importance of the Sound Money issue. I'm going to just share with our audience a little bit about that contest you guys got.
Yeah, so we've been doing since I believe 2017. We've done the Sound Money Scholarship. We have been honored to have Blue Ribbon panels of judges. These are people who lecture at Mises U. These are academics in at different schools across the country. These are people that have their finger on the pulse on political and economic issues across the country. And that includes people like Jeff Deist, Peter Klein, Bob Murphy, Keith Weiner, and yours truly, Tho Bishop, will be joining us on our panel this year. We're honored to have him. Every year we ask students, high school seniors, undergrads, and graduate students to write about 800 to 1,200 words on one of the prompts on the website. The website, you can find that at moneymetals.com/scholarship. These are questions about monetary issues, economic issues from a free market Austrian perspective. And then we go through them. The judges, this blue ribbon panel of judges read the essays, grade the essays, and then we will present the winners, we'll publish them, and there is a monetary prize as well. So if you have any interest in this, if you want to have an interest in economics, if you want to be published, and if you want to earn a couple extra bucks to go to school to mitigate some of the outrageous cost that is paying for tuition to go to a school, please feel free, moneymetals.com/scholarship, and you find more information there.
Great. We'll include a link in the show notes on our various platforms. But JP, this has been a fun conversation. Keep the great work. And as a frequent Mises Wire contributor, documenting some of these important changes being made out there, and in some cases, maintaining the gains that we have already made. Mm-hmm. If people are interested more in this topic, they can find your byline at the Mises Wire there as well. So always a pleasure talking, JP.
Yeah, great seeing you, though.
Until next time, this has been Tho Bishop. This has been Radio Rothbard.